Welcome back, friends. So Sarah was talking about that we had misnotion of what beauty or the outward sign of what marriage is, or there's just great confusion everywhere. And I go back to, I think John Paul's definition of love is really, it's succinct and it's pertinent. It's sincerely seeking the good of the other. It's that sincere gift of self. It's the concern for the other before the concern for my own welfare. And when she was describing old love as being more beautiful than young love, that is exactly right. And that's what captivated, that is what the image of an old love has captivated my mind for, I've been married 41 years. And for that, where the husband instinctively looks for the wife's hand to get her, through the uneasy path, or, honey, you know, I'm going to get, can I get something for you? And it's just a constant, unconscious, if you will, that's what virtue is, right? It's just the habitual good. So you don't even think about doing good at that point. Whereas the young wife, well, is he going to want this? Does he not want this? I got the kids to deal with, you know, and that sure looks like whatever. That's at the young stage.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm not quite as far along the marital path as you, but yeah, I've got 31 years. We have 31 years underneath our belt. And there is, you know, one thing I was sort of touched by, and I didn't really like the picture necessarily, but it meant a lot to my daughter who took it. You know, Greg and I were driving back with the family in the, you know, the big red, well, I don't know if it's the red van or the blue van, but whatever, one of those big vans. And our hand, we're just holding each other's hand. And to us, I didn't even know that we were holding hands until she took a picture of it, right? But it's that, it's the deferral of the self. How beautiful it becomes that self-sacrifice becomes habituated and normative, right? That you long for their good. I mean, and that doesn't mean that everything is all, you know, puppies and roses and, you know, whatever. But it does mean that the habit is instilled, and so the lived life begins to take a flow that is peaceful and pleasant and generally, I don't know, happy. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. That, you know, you look back on all those times that are sorrowful, and there's a bit of pride that recognizes that the yoke didn't pull too tightly, and that somehow one yielded to the other, and you made it through that. And I think that there's just a sorrow that for people that they don't understand that marriage must naturally be of long duration. And really, when you think about it in terms of like the efficacy of these other sacraments, you know, the one that when baptism, it's essential that the person upon receiving this outward sign has the full assurance of the promise that is there. The same thing would be true for absolution. One must be certain that at that very moment that grace has intervened. But in marriage, it truly is, and even like the Blessed Sacrament, right? I mean, when we go to the church and we receive the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ, that Eucharistic, to be within the Eucharist, right? To have our Christ's body, blood, soul, and divinity presence within us is of longer duration than the pouring of the water. It's of longer duration than the absolution, but it has to come to its end. But the sacrament that comes with marriage is unbelievable and beautiful in its endurance. Single day, every single minute, every single hour, you can call upon the grace of that sacrament, and it is as present to you at that moment as it was when it was first bestowed, as present to you at that moment as it will be, you know, God willing, after 60 years of marriage. I mean, that is astounding.
It is astounding. So let's see. Why do I have, do you hear an echo? No?
I'm not hearing an echo. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that. Every so often we have a little tech, as people are familiar with at this point.
Right.
Oh, let's see what Father Ringers, he's a Capuchin. He submitted this article to Homiletic and Pastoral Review, Ignatius Press, published date 1999. So let's see what 20 years ago he had to say. And Father's going to present the case from both reason and revelation. And I'm not going to be reading it in entirety. I'm going to just take out some choice paragraphs. Why the man or husband should be the head of the family, and why, in the words of St. Paul, wives should be submissive to their husbands. So we took up birth control right out of the gate, so let's tackle this one too. The family needs a head, and a there is important. It is not hard to get people to agree that parents have true authority. It is especially difficult in our modern society to get people to agree that the family must have a head. It's true. There must be in a family one person to make some filial choices. I think the word should be final. In short, we are saying that the husband and the father is the head of the family and has a true authority over the wife. He has the right to command. This does not mean universally, indiscriminately, but in a defined area. To define this area requires discussion by the individual husband and wife. So it's the husband and wife that kind of come to this area of definition. This does not mean that the area is completely to be determined by subjective mutual agreement, which would be a discussion. The nature of things according to God's plans will demand some priorities for the husband and some for the wife. The bonum fide, the good of the faith, for instance, will have to have a priority of choice. Moral goods have a priority over economic advantage. But a large part of the area will differ for different couples according to their own agreement. Eventually, the area will be determined, and within this area, the wife owes obedience to the husband. He has the right to command, which means to make the choice. The reasons for saying that the husband and father exercise a true authority are logical and theological. The logical are derived from reason. The theological reasons are based on revelation given in Holy Scripture. So first, we're going to examine logical reasons for the need of the head of a family. And I see, we're gonna, if you have some, after your thoughts, if any, then we'll go into the reason.
I think that what he's saying is very interesting. I mean, in regards to, I mean, if marriage is to make a oneness, then it only stands to reason that there has to be some level of responsible headship. But, you know, we have divorced the unitive element. We have divorced ourselves from the procreative element. And so for people who have already done that, there's going to be a very difficult reconciling of a oneness in authority. It's going to be very, very challenging. For people who have believed that there is a oneness of body, right? Or a oneness of soul, shall we say, there's going to be less of a difficulty in coming to mutual agreements on the oneness of the mind, right? That this is going to become very, very logical at some point. But again, I think that, you know, that's going to be a stumbling block for many, because they have become so enamored of their own will that to submit it to anyone seems like a divorce from the self.
It's exactly right. Exactly right. All right, my friends, we're going to talk about two co-pilots not needed in the next episode. Tell them, fide sedratio.